So the very first time I got punched in the face was in sixth grade music class. And I gotta say, it's actually a moment I'm kind of proud of. You see, there's this kid in our grade, and he's just one of those, man, he's one of those kids that just had the cards stacked against him. There wasn't much going from him. And in sixth grade, bullies at that point, it's pretty much the worst it gets. I mean, it was ruthless. Other classmates of mine, some of the guys, even the girls, man, they used to tear him up verbally, just awful. They were so harsh to this kid. And I'll never forget sixth grade music class, and we're all sitting in a circle with little wooden instruments. I don't know what we're doing with them, but probably playing them. But the music teacher had left. And of course, the second the teacher left, they lit right into this kid. And one kid in particular, I mean, he's out of his seat and he's right in his face, just giving him a hard time. And on this day, you know, this kid, he never stood up for himself, you know, which is obviously why they were so relentless. But whatever added up, whatever happened, today was different. And he came flying out of his chair and he stood up for himself. And the whole time I'm sitting there waiting for somebody else to do something. I'm like praying for the teacher to come back to put an end to this. And he came up out of his chair, and of course, the bully didn't like that, and so he pushed him. He went to push him back in his chair. He pushed him so hard, he sat down in the chair, went tumbling over backwards across the floor, and that was my threshold. Yeah, that was too far. Never have I seen them actually physically bully and actually physically abuse. And so I got up, and I told him to knock it off. And then he came at me, of course, because I'm the next one standing up, and so I pushed him. And he came back, and he led with his fist right into my nose, and that hurt. That's the first time I'd ever really gotten hit in the nose. That is super, super painful. And I reached up and I realized my nose was bleeding. And of course, that is the exact moment that the teacher walked in, right? Of course. He's standing there. I'm sitting here. I've got a bloody nose. He's looking at me like, what are you going to say? Like, I'm dead meat. You know, don't tell her. And I'm looking at him like, I pushed him first, kind of started it. Am I in trouble? I don't know. I've never been in a fight before. And I said, oh, I got a bloody nose. And he piped her up. Yep. I'm just getting up to get him a tissue. So he scampered over and he got me a tissue and he took his seat and he's staring at me like wondering if I'm going to blow him in. And I sat down and I nursed my wounds and never was that instance spoken of again. I don't think my parents know that. It's amazing to stand up for someone. It's amazing to have that opportunity. It's even more amazing to have someone stand up on your behalf, to have someone fight for you. And not necessarily in a physical sense, but just in any sense. You know, we've been in those settings when someone's just coming at you verbally, when you're just being attacked or you're being accused, and it's mean and it's malicious and it's untrue and it's unfair and it's hurtful and it's damaging, and then somebody speaks up. All of a sudden, there's someone at your shoulder defending the fact that they know you better than that, and that person is not telling the truth or calling them out for just being miserable and just being mean. It's amazing how that low point becomes an incredible high point to realize that someone has come to your aid, that someone is fighting for you. We've been walking through a series in Nehemiah for the last few weeks. We're going to be on chapter 4, starting right at verse 1, so you can kind of work your way towards that. But you know, Nehemiah was called by God. He was a servant slave. He was a cupbearer to a pagan king, to a Persian king. And when he heard of the destruction, when he heard of the ruin in Israel, in Jerusalem, the walls of the city were down, and its people were hopeless and being abused and exploited, it broke his heart. And he mourned, and he wept, and he prayed to God that God would send him, that God would allow him to go, be the one to rescue Jerusalem. And as he prayed and he waited upon God, he's given the opportunity, finally, to give his request to the king. And not only does the king give him the opportunity to leave, but he gives him resources and he gives him men and he sends him with the letters that he would need to get through the country safely. He gave him the letters that he would need to lift the edict that very king gave that said the walls could not be restored. And almost immediately after arriving, we're introduced to a guy named Sanballat. Everybody's got Sanballats in their life. Everybody's got someone that just benefits from the weakness and vulnerability of others. We first meet him in chapter 2, and he speaks up when he finds out that they're thinking about rebuilding the wall. And he crops right up at the beginning of verse 4, because now the wall is being built. The work has actually begun. He's seeing it could actually happen. And in verse 1 of chapter 4, it says, "Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews." It is a sad and certain truth, but there are those that benefit from the weakness and vulnerability of others. Here is a man that had gotten rich and powerful by exploiting the Israelites, by exploiting their weakness and their vulnerability, and now walls are going up. And he's angry. He's angry because he knows what walls mean. Walls mean that there is going to be justice. Walls mean that there is going to be dignity and hope and goodness. And Sanballat, he wasn't interested in justice. He wasn't interested in goodness. They were no longer weak and vulnerable. It would affect his livelihood. It would affect his ability to be rich and powerful. In chapter, or verse 2, he launches into kind of what seems like a temper tantrum. And if you read through it quickly, that's all. But when you really dig in, he asks five questions that are just slams, just pinpointed, malicious slams against the Israelites and against what they're doing. Verse 2, "And he said in the presence of his brothers and the army of Samaria, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burnt ones at that?'" Now, it kind of sounds like a hissy fit. But if you start looking at all of those specifically, the first thing he says is, "What are you feeble Jews doing?" Interestingly enough, the word that was used in the Hebrew for feeble was an agricultural term. And it was used for like a withering, disease, dying plant. He stands and says to their faces, "What are you doing, you withering, dying, hopeless people?" He's attacking them very deeply, very personally. And then he goes on to say, "Will you restore it? Will they restore it for themselves? Are you going to restore a wall? What's a wall going to mean to you? What are you going to do with a wall? You don't have soldiers to defend it. You don't have an army. You think you're going to be safer behind the wall? Do you really think it's going to make you more secure because you build this wall?" He insults them personally. And then he just kind of insults them again, and he's questioning their security. He's questioning their physical security. "You really think that this wall, if you restore it for yourself, is going to make any difference?" Thirdly, he says, "Will they sacrifice?" Now, Sanballat was a Samaritan. He would have been extremely aware of the customs, the Jewish customs. He would have been extremely aware of what that blood sacrifice meant. He would have known that the shed blood of the sacrificed animal was what brought God's people back to him. It was what covered their sins so they could have communion with God. And here's Sanballat saying, "You really think this wall is going to make your sacrifices worth anymore? What are you going to do, sacrifice? You're going to make a wall and then you're going to make sacrifices and then you think they'll matter? Look at you, you're in ruins. You're feeble, you're weak, you're withering. It's not going to make your sacrifices to your God any more valuable." He says, "Will they finish up in a day?" Now, remember, these were not stone masons. These were not stone cutters. These were not craftsmen. We learned last week that those that built the wall, not a single professional builder is mentioned in the whole book. It was jewelry makers and politicians and priests and perfumers, like literally makers of perfume. So Sanballat is looking at these men and they're feverishly working to build this wall. He said, "You think you're going to finish up in a day? You have so far to go. You can't keep this pace up. You're never going to finish. You don't know what you're doing." Very pointedly, strategically attacking their plan. And then lastly, he says, "Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burnt ones at that?" So the construction of a wall back then would have gone like this. They would have been cut limestone blocks, and an outer shell and an inner shell would have been created. For the sake of this wall was approximately 15 feet thick. So there would have been an outer kind of shell and an inner shell 15 feet apart. And then in the void that was created in between those two walls, they would have put like crushed limestone and clay. And that crushed limestone and clay would have compressed into basically what is comparable to like modern day cement. And the outer walls just kind of held it all together. But they didn't have the time or the resources or the ability or the expertise to cut fresh limestone. And so they're digging through the rubble that had been the wall and they're trying to scavenge whatever they can to rebuild. But if you remember The city had been burned. The gates had all been fired. Jerusalem had been burnt to the ground. You can't burn limestone. When limestone is fired, when it's burned, it becomes brittle and it cracks. It becomes almost like chalk. These blocks would have been very weak. There would have been very few that were actually whole. They would have been chunks of block, and they're trying to make a wall. And Sanballat just attacks the material. So he starts off right off the bat. Man, he's on a roll. He just slams him personal and calls him feeble. And then he insults their physical security, saying, well, what do you think a wall is going to do for you anyway? And then he slams them spiritually, their spiritual security, saying, you really think that God's going to want your sacrifice more because you have a wall? And he says, you don't even know what you're doing. You don't even have a plan. You're working so hard, so fast, it's unsustainable. Obviously, you don't know what you're doing, and the materials you're using are junk. Bully see is bully do, right? So his buddy Tobias is an Arab. He's standing right next to him. He decides to jump on the bandwagon. And in verse 3, it says, Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him. And he says, yeah, what are they building? If a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. He's basically saying, that wall is such a piece of junk that if a little tiny 4-pound fox were to scamper up there, it would just collapse. You know, the hardest part would have been the fact that this big lie that they were telling contained a lot of truth. I mean, they didn't know what they were doing, and they knew that they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't have good materials, and they knew that they didn't have good materials. They could stand back and say, yeah, okay, so the wall that we're building doesn't really look like any wall that we've seen. It does kind of look like a piece of junk. Aren't the most damaging lies in our lives the ones that contain just a little bit of truth? It's amazing how our enemies will use little truths to tell big lies. Here's a group of people that had risen up to give hope to their nation, to give security and dignity to their city. They had risen up in obedience to God to build a wall. That was one big lie. Sanballat was wrong. Sanballat was wrong, but there were truths weaving in amongst his lie. I've been fired once in my whole life. And the more experience I have, and the older I get, and the more I see the correct way of doing that and the incorrect way of doing that, the more I recognize that the way that I was let go was pretty much the most awful thing I've ever even heard of. But I was sat down in a chair across from my boss, and there were 3 or 4 other people in the room, and we were all given a letter, and the letter basically was a long list of reasons that I was being fired. And my boss proceeded to read that to the group, the people that I worked with, that I loved, that were friends still, right up until that moment. And when he was done with the letter, he wasn't quite satisfied, and so he went on a rant with a laundry list of reasons that I was being fired. And you know what? There was so much, it was just hogwash. I mean, there were things in there that weren't even factually true. Things I was responsible for that I wasn't even there for. And some of it had just was unfair, had been twisted, but you know what? Some of it was true. You know, there are things I could have done better. There are things I did wrong. There are things that I needed to grow from. And those little truths, those little areas that I needed to work on made me question the whole. Did I really know myself as well as I thought I did? If that's true, then maybe the rest is kind of true. It's amazing how the enemy can use little lies to tell a huge truth, but this would have had an effect on the Israelites. This was not a childish rant. This was a very pointed verbal attack for the sake of stopping them from building the wall. And I love how they respond. Verse 4 and 5. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives. Do not cover their guilt and do not let their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. That is not a prayer that I want to hear someone say about me. But I love the fact that Nehemiah chooses not even to address the insults. He doesn't even address Sanballat. He turns from Sanballat and he turns to God. He recognizes the fact that Sanballat's not attacking him. He is, but ultimately, he's attacking God. He's attacking the work of God in that land. He's attacking people that are giving of themselves and sacrificing and bleeding to build a wall to fulfill God's will. He recognized that not as someone that was coming at them personally, but as someone that was trying to stop the hand of God. And in verse 4 and 5, he calls down God's wrath upon their heads. He asks for God to make them be plundered in a land that they were captive. It's what they were guilty of. They had been plundering Israel. They had been plundering Jerusalem, a city that was being plundered under the captivity of the Persian Empire. He's calling for the punishment to fit the crime. Nehemiah turns away from the accusers. He turns away from the jeering and he prays to God. He commits it to God, recognizing that God will handle it. And then in verse 6, I love it. There's so much in verse 6. It's so simple, but there's so much. Verse 6, so we built the wall. He commits it to God. So we built the wall. And the wall was joined together to half of its height, for the people had a mind to work. We have a choice in life when we are met with that kind of scorn. We have a choice in life when we are met by that kind of intimidation and discouragement. How often is it that we stop doing what we're doing because of the discouragement? But what they're demonstrating here, they're demonstrating the fact that the scorn, that the opposition can also motivate us to work even harder. Recognize that that scorn is going to come, that the opposition is going to arise. There are always those that will stand up when the hopeless are being brought hope. When growth is happening, there will always be opposition. And so they go back to work. Now, in the Hebrew, mind and heart are interchangeable. So many historians even translations, if you have an NIV, it actually says a heart to work. These people, the translation was that they were working with all of their hearts. They were giving absolutely everything to this cause. It's important to recognize it said the wall was to half its height. Now, the wall surrounding Jerusalem, historians tell us, was between 10 and 14 feet high, depending on where in the wall it was. So it averaged around 12 feet. So if it's at half height, on average, it's around 6 feet. Now, if you're building a wall, something happens when you get to this point. You can't reach any higher without a ladder. You can't reach any higher without scaffolding. We're told in this verse that at this moment, when this opposition comes, the work has just gotten much, much harder and is going to continue to get harder every single day. Because now every single block has to get carried up a ladder or a scaffolding. Now every single basket of fill, every basket of rubble that's got to be dumped in has got to be carried up a ladder or a scaffolding. Can you imagine building a wall with nothing but ladders and scaffolding, and it hits 8 feet, and it hits 9 feet, and it hits 10 feet, and 11, 12, and before you know it, 14 feet with every block, 14 feet with every basket full of rubble, every basket full of fill. We find out from this verse that the opposition has arisen right when the work is getting the hardest and really beginning to get hard. Sanballat and his buddies are getting worried because they come back and they're still working. They're working with all of their hearts, and now the wall is half done. The wall is half done. All the breaches are closed up. There's no easy chinks. Now, no matter where they go, there's at least a 5 or 6 foot wall, which isn't much, but it's something. Verse 7 and 8. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. His insecurity and his livelihood, before when he was making comments and trying to stop it, it's just because his cash flow was going to be slowed down. Now he's looking at a city being rebuilt. An actual city with walls, and there's soldiers on those walls. And now it's looking more like a geographical threat. You'll also notice here that the number of guys is growing. I mean, as this city grows in the middle of an oppressed empire, the stronger they get, the more of a threat they become, and they're drawing attention, and Sanballat is doing his best to crush this opposition. Interesting note, geographically, Sanballat with the Samaritans was to the north, and the Arabs were to the south. The Amorites were to the east, and the Ashdodites were to the west. They were literally geographically surrounded by four major cities with standing armies that didn't want that wall to be finished. And now there's a plot to destroy it. And we prayed to our God, and we set a guard of protection on the wall day and night. Such an unbelievable habit that we can learn from Nehemiah. So many times he says, so we prayed and then we. That awesome picture of prayer followed up by action. The picture of actively doing everything that you can while waiting for God to come through for you. Unfortunately, the threats and the fear and the discouragement had its effect. I mean, right down to the soldiers, think about that. So he posted soldiers night and day on all of the walls all the way around the city. It's going to do two things. I mean, sure, they're going to feel a little bit secure because there's armies out there that want to destroy them. So the fact that there are eyes to the horizon waiting for an attack, that helps. But the other side of that is that those men on the wall are a constant, daily, every moment reminder that they are in mortal threat. Every moment of every day. Those men on those walls day and night are in every moment of every day, constant reminder that there are now less men working on the wall, and the work is getting harder and harder and harder. Can you imagine knowing that your daily grind will literally get harder every single day? You know, just put yourself in that position. You know the wall is half done. You're at 5, 6, 7 feet of height. So it's not, every time you build a little bit higher, you've got to build a bigger ladder. Every time you build a little bit higher, you got to build your scaffolding a little bit higher. Every time you get a brick to the top of that wall, you're climbing a little bit higher. Every time you carry a basket full of debris and gravel and pottery and junk, you've got to climb a little bit higher. Just when it's getting really hard, just when they're recognizing and they're starting to picture, okay, if this is 7 feet, what's 14 feet look like? Now they've got to deal with this. I mean, haven't you been there? I've been there in my life before. I'm like, you know what? This is really hard. I'm done. This is the top. Thank you, God. I know my limit. I can't deal with any more. And then, boom, you're surrounded. And you just find yourself thinking, God, why this now? Why this now? Really? Like, really? I'm just occurring to me that it's going to get harder every day, and now I'm surrounded by enemies? Now there's even less of us to work on the wall? Really? It's a pretty low point, and it's reflected in the text. In Judah, it was said, the strength of those who bear the burden is failing. There is too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall. And our enemies said, they will not know or see until we come among them and kill them to stop the work. And at that time, the Jews who lived near them came from all directions and said to us, 10 times, you must return to us. All of a sudden, their hearts are failing. All of a sudden, the excitement from the build and that passion is waning, and they're exhausted, and they're tired, and now they're terrified. And they're beginning to mumble amongst themselves, I don't think we're going to do it. I don't think we can complete it. I don't think it's going to happen. And all the while they're toiling, and all the while they're talking themselves back into getting up in the morning and going to work on the wall, they know that their enemies are outside plotting to kill them. That's not even the worst part. The worst part is verse 12. Can you imagine having a task, having a calling, of that magnitude, of that importance, something that you believe with all of your heart and mind is the most important thing that you're supposed to be doing. But then it says that people came from all over trying to bring them home. The war preparations would have been obvious on all sides. Those living in the countryside would have recognized that their friends, that their family, that their loved ones in the city were in mortal danger. And we're told that 10 times or over and over and over again, people are coming into the city trying to get their loved ones out. It's my wife, Carolyn, coming to me and saying, honey, the wall is important, but it's not that important. We've got 4 kids. I can't do this alone. I won't make it if you die. And have you seen the army that is amassing outside of the gates? The threat inside of the wall of fear and discouragement was very, very real. The threat outside of the wall from all sides was very, very real, and it was looming. To say that this was a low point in the project is probably like the biggest understatement ever. Verse 13 is amazing. Nehemiah, God was with Nehemiah. So in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, in open places, I stationed the people by their clans with their swords, their spears, and their bows. He didn't station the people on the piece of wall that they were working on. He didn't say, okay, I want all of the jewelers over here, and I want all of the politicians over here, and I want all of the jewelry makers over there. No, he stationed them by clan. He stationed them by family. He put each family, each male, each man in the family personally responsible to protect their wife and children. Can you picture yourself standing behind a half-finished wall at one of the low points, peeking through and see the armies of your enemies amassing? And you've never held a sword. You're not a soldier, but behind you is your wife and your children. Your mother and your nieces and nephews. It's me standing shoulder and shoulder to my father, who's a retired pastor, my brother who works in financing, and his 2 teenage boys, and my brothers. And behind me is my wife, and Elena, and Katie, and Isaac, and Eric, and my sisters, and my mother, and my nieces. You want to talk about motivation to not run? You want to talk about motivation to fight in a way that is superhuman and supernatural? You put a sword in the hand of a man and stand him between his enemy and his family. And that had its intended effect. And Nehemiah looks, and he looks into the faces of the people, and he sees that they are terrified. Now, remember, and if you're a lady or a daughter, if you were someone that wouldn't have a sword, it goes the other way too, right? I mean, maybe you're just coming to the city trying to get your husband out, the jewelry maker that's never held a sword. And now you're standing behind the jewelry maker, and he's your only protection, he and his sword. It's added effect to this. Some of you ladies may feel very secure behind your man with a sword, and some of you maybe less secure. And he sees the fear, Nehemiah does, and he sees the discouragement, and he goes out to his people. And in verse 14, he says, "And I looked, and I arose, and I said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." It's reminding them of the greatness of the call, reminding them of the greatness of the cause, reminding them that the wall that they are building is for their wives and their daughters and their sons and their families and their homes. It's why they're there. He reminds them that the enemies of God do not have God on their side. He reminds them that the enemies of God don't have a cause that's worth more than their lives. But they did. We do. Verse 15. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each of us to his work. That's a smart commander right there. I gotta tell you, I don't care how big my army is. I don't care how experienced my soldiers are. If I arrive at a city and I see that every single man and boy has been put personally responsible for the safety of his family, that is not a battle worth having. Even if they won, it would not have been worth it. I love it too, because in verse 15, that word frustrated, it's actually used in Ezra. The only other place in the Old Testament that it is used is in the book of Ezra, when they're first trying to rebuild the wall, and the enemy frustrates their plan to build the wall. And then a chapter later, it comes full circle, and we find out that God has frustrated the enemy's plan, and that this wall is going to be built. From that day on, half of my servants worked on construction, and half held the spears, shields, bows, coats of mail, and the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building on the wall. Their workforce, again, cut in half. But we find out that despite the incredible pressure, despite the threat, despite the hard work, despite the fact that they have now half as many people working on the wall, they're not stopping. They're armed to the teeth. Despite the opposition, their leadership is behind the build. Despite the opposition, they are in agreement still that this is what they need to do. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with the other. Now, remember I told you that there's an outside shell and an inside shell, and a great deal of fill needed to be put in there. A huge number of their labor force would have been doing nothing but carrying baskets and dumping them over a wall, which I guess technically you only need one arm for. So all of these people that were carrying baskets of rubble all day, climbing up the scaffolding, climbing up the ladder, were doing it with one hand, with their sword in the other, never putting it down. And each of the builders, who needed both of their hands, and each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me. And I said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, the work is great and widely spread, and we are separated on the wall far from one another. Now remember, when he had the wall rebuilt, he divided the wall into 40 sections, and he assigned people to specific sections of the wall. So he had literally spread them as thin as he possibly could have spread them for the sake of building the wall. And he recognizes this as a serious defensive issue. If a part of the wall is going to be attacked, an absolute minimal number of people are actually going to be there. And so he gets a ram's horn. And he says that if the sound of the attack comes, listen to verse 20. My favorite verse in the whole passage. In the place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. Despite all of his planning, despite all of his preparations, despite Nehemiah thinking it through and preparing the people, the battle belonged to God. Nehemiah understood that when we are doing God's work with our lives, the battle is always his. Think of every story in his word. David and Gideon and Moses and Joshua. Men, leaders that were willing to just show up, no matter how absurd the odds were, no matter how ridiculous the instructions were, they were willing to show up, sword in hand, and let God fight for them. Verse 21 through 23. So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. Until the stars came out. Not until sunset. Until the stars came out. I mean, think about that. You know how much time lapses in the evening before the sun dips finally below the horizon and the stars actually come out. These people were working late, late into the night. No matter how high the wall was, no matter how high they had to carry the blocks, no matter how high they had to carry the materials, they're working late into the night. I also said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem. They may be a guard for us by night and by labor by and may labor by day. Nehemiah recognized two things for all those people that lived out in the countryside that would rather travel home at night. Number one, every night they were in extreme danger. I mean, they were leaving when the stars came out. These people are leaving late, late at night to go home. And from four sides of the city, their enemies knew that they left night after night. And so he calls them in. And he also realizes the security threat of all of those people coming in from the countryside in the morning. You would have had a huge influx of people traveling into the city. It would have been a perfect opportunity for an assassin or someone like that to come in and to wreak havoc amongst them. Not to mention the obvious effect of having all of those men stay there if they got attacked at night. And then verse 23, so neither I nor my brothers nor my servants nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes. Each kept his weapon at his right hand. They never took off their swords. Ever vigilant, ever prepared, ever ready for the attack. It didn't matter that they knew that God would show up and fight for them. They were going to do everything that they could and then expect God to show up and fight for them. Ephesians 6. That famous passage about the armor of God. You know, we've got the armor of God. You've got the helmet and the breastplate and the shield and the belt and the boots and the sword. There's no scabbard. There's nowhere to rest your sword. We are called to be ever, ever vigilant. And I love in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 13, it says, therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all to stand firm, stand therefore. Having done all that you can to stand, stand. Having done everything that you can to prepare. Having actively waited for God to show up. Having actively waited for God to fight for you. All you have to do is stand. Obviously, Nehemiah did not wear his sword all of the time. Obviously, Nehemiah did not go through the preparatory security measures that he did because of a lack of faith. He did everything that he did because he understood that faith does not mean less work. He understood that faith does not mean less work. Faith means that in everything we do, the battle is God's. God rose up Nehemiah to awaken a hopeless people. People that were surrounded for generations by ruin and decay and brokenness. God used a pagan ruler to lift his own edict, to resource the whole job, so that hopeless people could have hope. But you know what? Whenever the hopeless are brought hope, there will be those that rise up. No matter what part of your life you're trying to rebuild, whether it be a marriage or finances or a job or a relationship, no matter what you're trying to rebuild, when you start to get traction, when things start to change, when the hopeless begins to feel more and more like hope, the enemy is going to be terrified because hope gives you courage, and courage gives you strength and growth and movement. There will always be those that when we are growing will rise up to steal that from us. There will always be those that benefit from us being down and out, that benefit from us being hopeless. There will always be enemies of God. There will always be enemies of justice enemies of goodness, and they are terrified of hope. Nehemiah and those brave Israelites were surrounded. And they did everything that they could. Everything that they could. Nehemiah did everything he could think of to make them as safe as he could, and then expected God to show up and fight their fight for them. I don't know what your sixth grade music class story is. I don't know if you're the one defended. I don't know if you're the one being defended. Maybe you've never been defended. Maybe you've never felt fought for. Maybe there are times in your life that you were getting, that somebody was coming at you, that somebody was just tearing you apart, verbally or physically or whatever, but somebody was just coming at you with slander and with lies and with accusations. And maybe nobody did stand up. Maybe it was full of a room of people that you really thought would have said something, you really thought you could have counted on. Maybe you've been a Nehemiah. Maybe you've brought hope to the hopeless. Maybe you've had the opportunity to stand up for someone and to fight for someone. What are you surrounded by this morning? What is it that threatens to discourage you and destroy you? What is it that the enemies of justice and goodness are the most afraid of you having hope in? Maybe it's a marriage that is struggling. Maybe it is a relationship with a child. Maybe it is a financial situation. What enemies are at your gates this morning? What is the enemy trying the hardest to keep you down and out and away from? Because as hard as it is to recognize that it is simple, Ephesians 6 is simple. It's not easy, but it's simple. We are called to do everything that we can and stand. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, there are few things more powerful than the thought that you are fighting for us. That while we are called to do everything that we can, ultimately the battle belongs to you. Ultimately, when we rally together, when we pull together, we can know that you will fight for us. Even if it's felt like we've never been fought for before, even if it's felt like we've never been stood up before, you show us again and again and again and again in your word that you bring hope to the hopeless. You send Nehemiahs in our lives to rebuild and to redeem and to restore us. Give us the strength that when that rebuild happens in our life, that when that redemption happens, when that restoration happens in our life and in our relationships, we will remember that while we are called to do everything that we can, you will fight that fight for us. In Jesus' name.